The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Noelia Martinez, Head of Data Science and Astrophysics at unbound.com. First of all, thank you for taking the time. I've been looking forward to the show since last time we spoke.
Thank you for inviting me.
No problem whatsoever. And, you know, I think it's really interesting your background and, you know, what you're working on at the moment. And I think you have, you know, a lot of really strong ideas as well that we'll certainly kind of uncover as we go on in the show. But, you know, it's really interesting that you're in data science and, you know, your background, I suppose, is different yet again. It's becoming such a common theme that almost every data science person that I speak to has, you know, quite a completely different background, which is, I suppose, it keeps mm-hmm. things really interesting. But, you know, your background was quite academic. So I'll kind of be interested to hear you kind of explain a little bit about your kind of background and, you know, the kind of academic route that you went down and kind of what that involved.
Yeah. Well, I think I've been a data scientist all my life, to be honest, because I've been analyzing data since I started my career. Mm-hmm. And for that, I had to use all the tools all the tools in state of the art and many others that are very well known. So my background is astrophysics, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of research and a PhD in numerical astrophysics. So I will spend my days simulating galaxies. And for that, I will know how to parallelize the computing in different clusters and how to integrate that data and then how to read that data, organize that data, use statistics to make sense of it. And then, you know, all those things that are those things I'm doing right now. So I don't see such a big difference.
Right.
In terms of the techniques, of course, I'm using machine learning, and when I have enough data, deep learning. And for that, yeah, I had to retrain myself, and I had to study. But the tools are based on mathematics and statistics, which I'm very familiar and very comfortable with. So I wouldn't say it's a huge change. It is a change more in terms of the fact that you are no longer dealing with entities of galaxies or mm-hmm. trying to figure out absolute laws, the nature laws, but you have to understand a business problem and you have to be very quick because a decision that you make now might affect the business very quickly and you have to have the decisions. You have to you are there for optimizing and making it better and more intelligent. So I think that's different, yes, because mm-hmm. The rush is another, and yeah, that's probably the most different thing. But yeah. not in terms of the techniques and the type of work. So yeah, so I understand you mean that. I don't know what I actually was going to ask you. What is a data scientist anyway? So there are no careers on data science.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. So
yeah.
Data science are coming from different backgrounds
yeah.
by definition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's a great point. Yeah, it's a great question to ask. Is like, okay, so what is a data scientist then? I think it's massively misunderstood. I think because it's probably relatively new, I think it's probably okay to say that the coin term of data science is kind of in its infancy still. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions. I think from that, we do see a lot of mistakes happening at the moment, maybe from corporate, where people are assumptive that they may need a data scientist without fully understanding what they need. Maybe an analyst will do, you know, maybe an analyst will do instead for what their needs are. It's certainly something to clear up. But like as you said, you know, a lot of the problems that you were solving in academia, and I suppose the beauty of academia is that it gives you kind of the time to, you know, to think things through and really get a deeper understanding of things. But maybe, you know, the difference, as you kind of began to outline, with actually then working on a business problem and solving business problems, is that I suppose the maybe the time restraints are there. Maybe there's, you know, actual more outcome driven incentives.
Yeah.
What was the kind of, you know, the main difference for you where you were like, right, okay, I'm done with this academic stuff now. It's been fun, but you know, let's move on to solving some business problems now.
For me, it was the fact that I did 4 postdocs, and I was a little bit tired on the uncertainty of where I was going to end in the next one. So
right.
The academic world, it's a little bit destroyed, I would say, with this. The postdoc job shouldn't be there. It was supposed to be a patch between becoming a professor and being a PhD student. So this is a system that I think is collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gone for an academic career in Argentina, where I'm from, but to be honest, I thought like I don't like to have to. It's too complicated. You have to do science with little resources, and I don't think astrophysics is one of those. You
yeah.
really need to have a big lab. You need to have access to telescope data. You need to have huge computers. If not, you are really not doing the cutting edge things, but the niche things. And to be honest, I didn't think I would spend my life on doing something that no one care about. So I thought, well, I mean, what can I do with these tools? Where I could be doing something more relevant, I'd say. And also, to be honest, I think at the point it was for me a decision of, yeah, it's been enough of. It's been enough of having this life where you live in all the countries where with all the people, but in the end, you depend on grants or someone else telling you if your research is going to be doable or not.
Right.
So I thought I hated not to have control over that. So
yeah,
it's a problem that you'll see like many academics have faced, and at some point they either my friends keep on going and keep on living in different countries over 2 years and until they will get a position when they are, I don't know, 45 or something of the sort.
Right.
And I thought that was unacceptable for me. But yeah, it's a personal choice.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's the way it is. So for me, transition was pretty easy because I was offered a job directly after a school of data science, and I worked as a consultant for a year. So I got the general picture of what was out there and what were people doing in different businesses. And then I was invited again to join this wonderful company where they do books, and I love it.
Yeah.
So I said, for me, it was very easy. I know some people have different paths, but I was very lucky, I would say.
Yeah. What was the kind of biggest shock, I suppose? You know, day one, maybe, you know, starting off as a consultant, straight out of you know, academia. I think maybe a lot of people are under this potentially is like stereotypical impression of you just kind of freezing and being like, oh my god, you know, academics are probably work slower or whatever the stereotypes are. I think people probably have that you know, concept, but from your perspective, you know, what was that kind of initial straight into the corporate world like? Was it the shock that a lot of people would have expected it to be?
Well, yeah, I think it depends which company you choose to make the transition to.
Right, right, of course.
I think, for example, my company now, it's more similar to academia because everyone there, it's a writer or it's related to the literary world, and it works more like a little faculty where people are doing their jobs and we have meetings. But I mean, it's a deep working place in terms of like people are concentrated and probably sometimes very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about, I mean, it's business, but it's about making arts and books. So it's a different thing from the corp, I would say. Yeah, I think, I don't know what the stereotypes are, but I think for me, again, I'm lacking this because my whole family is, it works in business. My dad works in a company. He's the CEO of a company. My sister is an economist. So I didn't have this huge jump that I didn't know where I was going. I kind of knew what to expect. Sorry. The only thing I missed as an academic instantly was the freedom of doing whatever I want.
Right.
To arrive to a place where I had to be at a certain time, dressed in a certain way, and be told what to do was probably too much for me. But after a couple of days, we eased that and we had a couple of talks, and then things were easier. But I would say, yeah, that's the first one. I think people that have been in the academic world and liked it, like me, because I didn't run from it because I didn't like it, I wouldn't recommend that they jump into a corp, into a bank or something of the sort, unless the bank has already started to work in a more agile or open kind of startup way where people are a little bit free with flexible things. I don't really know how it's to work in a bank, to be honest, so maybe I shouldn't even say it.
But
because that's another pressure is, because I don't really know how it's to work in a bank. Maybe it's wonderful and people get used to some kind of routine, and I think there's a comfort in not thinking about what you're going to wear so much and just using kind of a uniform every day. I think it could be like, it depends on what would make you feel comfortable. So I think that's not a big issue. The big issue for me was the lack of freedom. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that it could happen, it didn't happen to me, but I've seen in my friends, is the lack of intellectual challenges. Mm-hmm. I've seen them very bored with stupid problems. And that's really a pity, because it's such a waste of human talent to put someone very prepared to go very deep into a superficial task, I would say.
Yeah, well, do you think that, I mean, this is probably a sidetrack to that, but do you think that to that point, things like automation is going to kind of alleviate that, and hopefully in the future, what it will do is act as a massively positive thing, because it will mean that, you know, humans will be able to, you know, that more people will be able to put their minds to more compelling projects and solve bigger problems, because we're kind of alleviating those kind of miscellaneous, you know, boring tasks. And maybe we shouldn't be kind of made to work on those things. That's obviously, you know, it's not necessarily my perspective, it's just a perspective on it. But do you think that, you know, that is massively the positive side of, you know, artificial intelligence and things of that nature?
Well, yeah, I've heard this one, but I think there are two kinds of jobs. So the ones that are repetitive and boring and make humankind become a monkey, yes, those are going to disappear, hopefully, and you'll have people that are getting the best of both worlds, so they can be creative and they can use computer tools, they can use the artificial intelligence to enhance that experience, but not to be replaced, but to be collaborative, I would say. So those kinds of jobs, I imagine, like an augmented reality, for example, that will help you to put things in order simply and more quickly and in a very smart way. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what I was saying is that people are trained as scientists to think in the cutting edge of things and to be bold and to look for alternatives, are given very specific problems in boxes to solve, and they cannot go out of the box. And I think that kind of problem won't be solved by AI. I mean, unless we can do a whole pipeline of the whole problem solved by AI. I think you'll need a human being thinking and extrapolating what's feasible. But to be, I mean, this is like in talking in 10, 20 years.
Yeah, of course.
Ahead from us, because probably the super intelligence that could erase could arise, sorry, from computers trained with all the data and all the algorithms and so, to become so smart that we don't need anyone anymore making decisions. But this sounds like a distant future, it seems to me, from what I've been reading. Those are speculations of things that are not that close, not yet.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, I think I wanna be positive and think that, yes, artificial intelligence will make our jobs more interesting.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. Well, I certainly hope so as well. I think you have to be optimistic about it. I think that it's change, and change scares people. But I think, you know, remaining optimistic and, you know, thinking about things from, you know, intelligence is freedom at the end of the day, you know, and if you're able to work on those, you have to be a smarter generation just because of what you're able to work on a day-to-day basis, then that can only be, you know, a positive thing, in my opinion, of course. I know that, you know, we wanted to kind of discuss this, but, you know, we obviously had Earth Day, and there's, you know, there's a lot of everything, it seems like, every other week. You know, we obviously had the, you know, Cambridge Analytica issues. We have, you know, it seems like the news is just bombarded with security, privacy, you know, data driven issues. Is every other week, it seems like. So, you know, we obviously recently had Earth Day, and I know that you kind of have some kind of strong opinions about around that. So definitely wanted to kind of give you the opportunity to kind of express those and, you know, give your kind of take on, you know, everything that's been kind of going on as a, in a kind of timely way with Earth Day.
Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised, to be honest. I'm disappointed that the scientific community that is, that has transitioned and it's in these spheres, in data science spheres, is not really following the principle of, okay, these are issues that are very important, not for us, mm-hmm. to be honest. I think I'm going to die in a world that's going to be probably okay, but it's for the next generation that I'm concerned. And I don't have kids, so I'm concerned by the rest of the kids, of the people. And it's like, I don't even see the strong voices, as you just said, that start talking about, these are conspiracy theories, or like we are going to talk from inside of what companies are doing, and Bent, like the Cambridge Analytica ex-employee who came out and said things he knew. I don't see such strong opinions. I don't see anything leaking, and I'm very worried because it's the first time in our human history that you can see all the data together from the oceans, data from satellites, tracking fishing, tracking the state of the plastic in the ocean. When you see the wildlife traffic, the wildlife destruction, the forest destruction, the way that the little rests of forest which have been patched by planting and being short-sighted and thinking you're going to make money in the next 10 years, yes, a lot, but destroying a forest is something that it won't be replaced in a million years. It took a million or 2 million years to build that diversity. And the problem I see, so I tell you what I think it's worrying, is that because this is such a huge problem that will involve so many different heads coming, so different kinds of solutions in the table, I believe that people are like trying to, maybe afraid of, or don't even want to realize the scale of the problem. And I think the people that see all this data together can, for the first time, put all this together, cannot ignore this anymore. And we should be speaking out. That's why I think I'm very concerned about this, like, because I do see that the acceleration of the global warming plus the disappearance of the diversity in the planet is going to change things in a way we cannot even predict. and there won't be technologies to solve it, because this has been a process in equilibrium for millions of years. We cannot just come with an app and solve this.
Yeah.
And I am so concerned, because it's that we are polluting and destroying the only place we know we're able to live. There's no easy way to go to Mars. People keep on telling me, yeah, we're leaving Mars in 10 years. What's not going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen in 10 years. And even if that was the case, you cannot transport almost 9 billion humans to Mars. I mean, it's the solutions are there. I think we have to talk about this and start seeing that it's going to affect our direct lives in ways we don't even realize. Like, global warming is going to make people migrate more than we see now.
Mm-hmm.
I am seeing, like, people don't like migration so much, especially in the northern countries. So if the Europeans are so concerned by migration of people in the third world, imagine how you could escalate these problems if everyone is moving from the regions that are no longer livable or are flooded.
Yeah.
Plus, the fact that we have to eat, and polluting everything we consume will come back to our sources anyway. So what I think is, like, there are two main things we should be doing. And first is acknowledging the problem and talking to two ends. So two ends of the problem are the people taking awareness, the people taking responsibility for the consumption, and making the big companies, making the governments comply with the minimum livable conditions for stopping this nonsense. And I think the political decisions won't come if there is no pressure from the people. And unfortunately, people won't be informed if there is no data to see, and if there's no people talking about it. So it's a vicious circle, because it keeps on being ignored. And I think it's our main problem. It's our main problem, because, as I say, specialists and researchers have been saying this, like, we cannot be ignored for more than, I don't know, they already settled a threshold. It's like every year they move it a little bit more, because we know we cannot achieve what we propose. So the the Paris proposal was supposed to be for 2020, I think, and we are not going to be there. So let's move it a little bit more. And I think that's unacceptable. That's what I think. I think it's unacceptable, and it's urgent.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you said, there's no avoiding it now, because we do have the access to the data, and it almost shouldn't be a political issue, and I think that's the underlying factor, right? Is that it shouldn't be as political as it is, but it still continues to be. Even with all the access to the data that we now possess.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, imagine that if we tell everyone we should stop consuming as much as we do.
Yeah.
Because this is an overconsumption problem as well. So these societies, the Western societies, are consuming too much of everything.
Yeah.
We should reduce the way we live, and we should probably have less than one kid per family. I mean, one, or that's it. Do you think that's not a political decision? Who's going to take that decision? I mean, that's the problem. It's a huge, deep problem.
Yeah.
And no one wants to acknowledge, because we acknowledge it and start talking. Who's going to take the political risk of saying these things out loud?
Yeah.
Who's going to stop saying, like, we should, I don't think the capitalism is ready to say, yeah, we should stop consuming. And probably that's the big issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a valid point. And, there's obviously something that's been rolled out today around the kind of consumption factors around the reusable plastics, for example. You know, that I saw on the news this morning that, you know, I think it was Asda and another kind of big retailer had kind of committed to alleviating all non-recyclable plastic by 2020, I believe, something like that. But you think it's a much bigger problem than that? I mean, these are obviously, you know, the big players that we need to lead the way and make these kind of drastic decisions, and it needs to come from these corporations because they're private and, you know, they can't necessarily be massively dictated in the way that they operate, because obviously they have a bottom line to consider, which essentially will affect things. But, you know, steps like that must be positive. But do you think it's, you know, it's probably still not enough to just consider, you know, these kind of huge retailers like that to make, you know, recyclable plastic, for instance?
Yeah, so I think that's great that they do that. I think it's the first step. Mm-hmm. It's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I still believe that if we had, I don't know how to put it better, but if I could convince the people to see the magnitude of the problem and how many things will have to come at the same point better. So inequality in the world, it's also a problem. And you cannot solve deforestation without solving inequality, unfortunately. So it's so complicated that that's why I'm pessimistic. I'm saying, like, this is urgent. This is urgent, and I'm very worried. As a scientist and also as a person that reads the news and wants a better future, and I don't see anyone so concerned. I mean, I see my special communities where I hang out and we talk about this, but, like, I don't understand how thinking, well-informed people are not that concerned. I really don't understand.
Indeed. Well, I think it's a great point to raise. It's just, do you think that now we have the data, that this is kind of a pivotal moment? Do you think that there's things that we can do with data to try and influence these decisions? Or is it simply just kind of being able to present the data, and then we still have kind of a political barrier that is essentially causing any delays to productivity?
No, I think you're right, because, like, people want to take action in the end. And if I make anyone conscious of a problem, the very first thing they say is, okay, but how can I help, really? And yeah, so there are many places where you can help. There are, for example, the wildlife organization has an international community where, for example, taking awareness of this and donating, because many of these things depend on small private NGOs doing what they can legally. So I think, unfortunately, at this point, I would say, like, taking a conscious of what's going on, awareness of what's going on, and probably start making pressure and informed decisions and following up what's been done. But, I mean, if you know how to call, there are people that will volunteer for helping this network trafficking and things like that. Facebook is one of the companies that offers, for example, without wanting to, I don't know, without any control. Mm-hmm. Illegal wildlife objects and animals, and I think they're the first to be, like, aware that, okay, they should be controlling who's putting that into the platform, who's using their platforms. Unfortunately, with the internet, you also have access to things you didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And that will be, for example, to the beautiful wildlife that you shouldn't have in home, but you can buy it through internet. The other one, I would say, that's very surprising that didn't join this huge effort is Amazon. Mm-hmm. And that was surprising for me. I didn't see any explanation of why. But so the wildlife, it's one of the problems. The destruction of the wildlife is one of the problems. And then, of course, if you can go and hear different voices, they will tell you more or less, if we start stopping the press that will glorify having 13 kids, something that's glorious and wonderful. Well, it's not anymore. Not with the limited resources of this planet. 13 people more to feed, it's absolutely irresponsible. So those kinds of things, I would say.
I think it's all valid. And I think it'll be compelling to see what happens. I suppose, like, say, all we can do at this point is raise awareness. And I think we will see strides. I think that we are seeing that. It's just a process, isn't it? You know, we're kind of, it's an uphill battle because, like you say, you're, you know, fighting consumerism at the end of the day. So it's just how much more, you know, efficient can we be with consumerism? Because I don't know whether it's ever you're ever going to be able to alleviate that. It's just against, I suppose, human nature, isn't it, at the end of the day? So it would be, it's a fascinating thing. And I think it's great that you're being, you know, so passionate about it. And, you know, hopefully, I'm sure that you'll continue to kind of share your voice and voice your opinion out, you know, whenever you get.
Yeah, but I'd rather everyone. Yeah, everyone, every time I have like an opportunity, everyone will, yeah, they know me. I'm very annoying. But I'm just because I'm really sure it's the good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even for me, to be honest. This is not me being selfish.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think so. I think it's.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity of venting again.
Yeah, no. Anytime you want to come on and have a vent, it is absolutely fine with me. It's always really interesting to have you on the show. I've looked forward to it for the last couple of weeks, and yeah, it was great fun. So we'll leave it there. I know you've got a lot to get back to. So thank you so much for taking the time out of the day. It was really nice chatting with you. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.